Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we will continue our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. Last weekend in Los Angeles, Maj and I co-hosted two evenings of an Expanding Mind Salon. Very interesting and eclectic mix. It was held at the Annie Besant Hall, an old theosophical lodge hall with some very interesting vibrations, and had a mixture of speakers, conversation, performances. And one of the highlights for me, in it anyway, I think probably for everyone was there, was a remarkable work of spectral artisanry or psychographia. There's many ways to describe it, and we'll have to give you more details with our guest today, Christian Cummings, who was an artist and one of the para folks who, using a Ouija board, contacted spirits with his partner, Michael Decker, and then proceeded to have a conversation and then to create a set of drawings. It was a very interesting art occult intervention, and they've been doing it for about 10 years now, and it's a very interesting, thought-provoking spectral performance. And so we'll be talking with Christian about that, and I'm really looking forward to that particularly because, you know, one of the things we look at a lot on the show is just the various ways that the so-called occult plays itself out in our modern lives. And in some ways, the relationship with art and art practice is the richest because it's the most ambiguous. Our culture is funny in that if you are, say, you're a philosopher or a spiritual person, people are going to be really very critical of any kind of fuzziness that you get into, you know, any kind of vagaries, any kind of ambiguities. It's like, well, what do you really mean there? You know, do you really believe there's a spectral being in the sky? Or do you really think that there are secret powers residing at the bottom of your spine? But if you're an artist, you kind of get a pass, because you're an artist. So we all know that artists are a little wacky. They play with different identities, different possibilities. And in a way, you do, especially in modern art situation, we've come to no longer even expect that the artwork expresses something profound or specific about the artist who's making it. So in a way, the art world becomes a space of ambiguity and possibility for precisely the kinds of explorations of the mysteries that from other angles, like the paranormal or the spiritual, in some ways become more constrained. And I think that Christian and Michael's work is a really good example of that. But before we bring him on, of course, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Eric. How's it going?
It's going pretty good. I think I'm recovered from our extravaganza.
Yeah, I'm good.
What was for you another highlight of our experience together?
Oh, man, there was so much good stuff. You know, I was just very delighted by some of the folks that you brought on that I had never heard about. I thought Veer Chappelle was fantastic.
We'll have him on the show. He did a great presentation about a 19th century sex reformer named Ida Craddock with some very interesting occult elements too.
Yeah. And, you know, it's always good to see a sword swallower. You can't really go wrong with that. I thought Brett swallowing three swords at the same time was pretty amazing to me. I don't know. You just don't see that every day.
It's true. I had never, I think I'd seen a sword swallowing done, but in the context of some kind of, you know, very polished, you know, cabaret-like thing, and it was just happening in the corner, and it was very clinical. And, you know, the thing about sword swallowing is, like, once you've seen it, you're like, okay, some people can put swords in their mouth and swallow them. They don't hurt anything. You know, it's like, got it. You know, that can happen. But so it's really like a lot of magic. It's as much about the framing and the performance. And Brett was amazing, and it was very visceral as well.
Yes.
There was no way of avoiding the internal aspect of the
totally.
Operation. Good thing to see live. Well, with that, we'll bring on Christian here on Expanding Mind. Welcome to the show, Christian. Are you there?
Can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah.
I'm here.
Excellent.
Great.
So I wanted to, you know, I think probably the obvious place to start is why you started mucking around with the Ouija board in the first place. Was it were you already thinking about this sort of art intervention, or was it more just from personal curiosity, or what were the circumstances of your initial forays?
Well, I think sort of both. At the time, Michael and I were students, and one thing that I think attracts a lot of people to go to art school is that the play and work sort of blend into one thing. And at the time, we were both working a campus job, and it was and I had purchased a Ouija board for some other deviant experiments, but we brought it in as a way to play hooky from our job, and had fashioned the tools. We were working in the shop, so we fashioned the tools in the shop and made the planchette so that it could hold a magic marker, and we're sort of expecting you know, it's like a Henri Michaud like scribble from another dimension, and the first drawing was a Ninja Turtle, and that really freaked us out, and that's what made us take it seriously.
At that point, did you go through and ask their name and things like that, or did you just start out with the drawing?
Well, we didn't have any expectations in the beginning, so the first one was a drawing, and then we naturally wanted to go back to the board and ask questions. So we asked the name of the person who made it and their age and where they were from, and that became the sort of standard protocol for all of the drawings. And now when we do it, we will ask their name, their first and last name. We'll ask them to title their drawing. And then we'll ask them the city they died in and the age that they were when they died, so we can check some of this stuff in the public record.
Well, and how often has it been, well, I guess you'd call it successful. Like, how often have you gotten information that you didn't know that that was corroborated later?
Well, you know, in the beginning, we had this idea, well, we will corroborate all, we'll be able to go back and look in the public records, so we're going to take all this information down. And we actually have never done that, but we've not gone to city archives or anything. But one time we were doing a drawing that was, the person claimed to have worked at a Togo's around the corner, a sandwich store. So we were able to go to the sandwich store and ask for the manager and ask them if so-and-so worked there. And the manager got really weird and
wow.
Was like, you know, were you friends of this person? His name was Tim Gundeman. And we said, well, yeah, we are friends of his. We kind of didn't let on that we knew anything about his mortal status. And the manager just said, yeah, well, he worked here 3 years ago, but doesn't work here anymore. And then also we had once Walt Disney came through and did some drawings, and he said some weird stuff that we didn't know. Like, he said that he kept on asking us to call him Elias, when we would call him Walt, and we found out that was his middle name. And also the drawing that he did was of this sort of goofy character driving an ambulance and kind of leaning out of the ambulance, and then, you know, just in Google we were able to find out that he tried to lie about his age and get into World War I, but they caught him because he looked so young, but he was able to pull the wool over the American Red Cross. And he went into World War I as a medic and drove an ambulance and supposedly had the time of his life and painted cartoon characters on his ambulance vehicle. And, and that was a little bit creepy as well.
That's definitely spectral. Now, have you, I know that, I think there's other people who have at least claimed to be famous people have shown up. I mean, on Sunday's performance, we had someone claiming they were John Dee, but it was pretty clear soon along that they were probably fibbing. Does that happen a lot? Do the spirits seem to like to, put on famous costumes, or have there been other attempts that you've made to contact famous artists and have them come through?
In my experience, they will, if you ask, if Anais Nin is on the other end of the phone, if they say yes, they're usually not that person. And we don't actually seek out celebrities. All of the celebrity folks that we've had come through, with the exception of one or two people, have come of their own accord. And those, celebrity peoples are easy to find information through Google on. We've had, like, one interesting one was the 17th century poet William Congreve, who I didn't even know existed until he came through. So, and aside from him, we had, like, one time we had a 1960s sculptor, Tony Smith, come through. And he made drawings of these very obscure sculptures that he had made in the 60s, and he titled the drawings the same as the sculptures, and we were able to find in a book images of these sculptures, which don't exist anymore. They were like black and white snapshots in his backyard or something. So then we also asked him his birth date, which he got right, which, we're not nerdy enough artists to know that. And we called it his foundation. He has a foundation. And we're like, well, your namesake is coming through on our Ouija board, and, we had some questions for you. And they just said, well, you can't use his name. And we had to say, we assure you he was using his own name. We weren't ones using it,
That's hilarious. I just realized that this whole conversation has been ghosted as well by your partner, Michael, who I didn't realize was calling in. So, Michael.
Oh, yay.
You're here. No?
No, he's a ghost.
Wow. Very spooky. Well, perhaps he will call back, or we'll get him on. I just got a little note from our engineer, so we'll continue. And if he pops up again, then we'll hear his voice, just like we did before. So then, these drawings that you've gotten, you told me that you haven't actually done anything with them, had a show, sold them. What? How do you even think about these things? Are they collaborations? Would you even put your name on it at all? How do you even think about it as an art act? Vis-a-vis the sort of question of attribution, which is so, important and vexing in art practice?
Well, we have shown them. We haven't sold them.
Oh, okay.
It's a funny question, and this is a project. Michael and I are both artists that do things other than this project, but I think for both of us, the project has informed everything that we do and how we think about art. So in some weird way, I'm trying to think of how to answer this. I guess my own personal feelings about art since the project is that it's not just a cultural production event, but it's more like a mutant instinct that humans have that's unrelated to our survival. And these ideas of it being a cultural production, or words like modern or postmodern, these kinds of things, are just words. These that imply that we use art as like our bodies use food to survive and to grow is just some weird leftover of a modern narrative of moving forward and progress. But in my opinion, where art and human beings even start to get interesting is when we have dreams or weird spiritual theories or deviant ideas or spontaneous thoughts that come from out of nowhere, which I think is the sort of territory of the spectral event, that this is the common occurrence for artists, that we are the people who are paying attention to our lightning bolt ideas that come to us unannounced as if from nowhere. And even though we don't think of them like ghosts, they sort of are ghosts. They feel like, when they're in our bodies, ideas. They feel like they have their own intelligence and that, like, they want to come out. And we feel, you know, what, as an artist, you feel it like it's a baby. It's consuming your energy. It's consuming your resources. And this, I think, the way that this changed how I think about art is now I think about art as a phenomenon that happens equally in me as it happened in cave persons, or as it happens in suburban post-millennial teens or something.
Well, it does. It takes it to the meta level, because, I mean, here art is not only like a thing for survival, but it extends past that, even into death. Like, if the idea that a ghost can do a drawing, like, that means that there's some, that art provides some kind of, like, aggregating mechanism for creation to take place. You know what I mean? And, I mean, the fact that a ghost could use that kind, like, one of the biggest things that strikes me when I watch it is that the ghosts are using this to, like, communicate and put something of theirs that's in this other place in, you know, in the dream world or the astral realm or whatever you want to call it, and then they put it into physical reality, and as such, they, like, communicate their story, whether it's, like, of an ambulance driver in the war or whatever, just by doing, like, this weird little funny drawing with a marker using, like, the little thing. So it does, I mean, your point that it transforms, like, what we even think the purpose of art is. Like, if someone thinks the purpose of art is, like, you know, for some bougie student to, like, draw a good picture, a pretty picture, I mean, the fact of what you guys are doing kind of, like, that obliterates that to me, in my opinion, you know?
Yeah, and getting back to what Eric said, connecting those kinds of ideas to contemporary art is really unpopular, because it sort of devalues and suffocates 100 years of material art history that, in my opinion, is, you know, aside from being sexist and male dominated and racist and regionalist and classist and all these other things, it's limited by a secular bias for self-evident reasons, having to do with modernity and you know, how culture happened in the last 100 years.
Well, it's a very interesting situation because, I mean, though the story is more complicated than this, in a nutshell, you know, art as such, the artist standing alone as an artist, is itself, that whole idea, is itself a reflection of the secularization that we associate with the modern era. You know, before the Renaissance, people, great artistic geniuses, you know, in music, in painting, in sculpture, in myriad civilizations, they weren't concerned with their signature. They didn't think of themselves as an artist, a character alone. Obviously, there was ego and competition. That's totally clear. But the whole idea of the artist standing apart from, let's say, religion is itself just that's where the artist comes from in the modern sense. And in a way, what it feels like what you're doing and what a lot of artists are doing now as they kind of begin to peel away and return to a sort of intensities that are outside of the secular norm. And you can even think of surrealism as a modern example of a movement and group of artists that were doing this as well. I mean, it's sort of a thread running through the story, but for the most part, it's profoundly threatening because it undermines the whole kind of built up story about what a capital A artist is. And then one of the things about that, and I'm really curious about that, is my impression is that the idea of inspiration, the idea of sort of some kind of spontaneous, obsessional, you know, urge or instinct that's coming through you that you're not responsible for is like a super uncool way to talk about art, at least in the more hoity-toity realms of art discourse these days, which is totally different than what you're talking about and what the religious or shamanic dimension of art practice implies. So how do you, I mean, talk about that inspiration idea from this perspective.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that the whole, if you think about the spectral psychography project dealing in a sort of literal way with this liminal idea of like the going between two worlds or something, and what I was saying before about this being a really common space for artists, almost as, you know, because now I kind of think of just all art as a form of channeling. I think that in some weird way, and it's also why surrealism is both, like, if there's, like when there was a Salvador Dali show in L.A., there was lines out of the door, but for some reason, Salvador Dali is still somehow unpopular in the sort of, in certain conversations about art. I think it's because we just don't know what we are. You know, it's like with the ghost. When we bring the Ouija out, people think that we're going to get like a tormented woman who was raped and murdered on the night of her wedding. You know, from the 19th century, from England, you know, pale face, you know, sheet, all of this kind of stuff. We have all these ideas of what we are and what the ghosts are and what the world is. But I think this messy stuff, the psyche or the self or inspiration, we just don't want to touch it because we kind of don't know how to. But I think that it's also a really common space where artists have been acknowledged, artists that have been acknowledged have explored it. You know, like for, in my opinion, there's not a lot of difference between like the sort of drunken master, holy fool character and like the beatniks, for instance. And we look at these guys, for us, their sort of deviation from the norm is institutionalized now. Like deviation, actually, we have a long tradition of deviation as this really, really important element to our story. And in some ways, I wonder if we aren't, as artists, as the sort of institution of art, if we're not protecting the norm so that deviation can still occur, so we can continue to surprise ourselves, and that we want to be confused and thrown off kilter in a way.
Well, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that could be that's a really interesting space. Who are some other people who are doing work around this kind of occult or sort of spectral dimension that you really resonate with, and maybe, you know, an example of the kind of stuff that other people are doing that are changing this relationship or making it more visible?
Well, one artist who I mean, there's a lot of people from, you know, the surrealist to William Blake to Henry Michaux or even Australian Aboriginal art. I mean, there's lots of people. Even Kandinsky wrote a famous tract called The Spiritual in Art, which was really influential on everyone from Picasso to Pollock, though it was sort of left out of the historical narrative. But one artist I think is really interesting is John McCracken, who was an L.A. minimalist or called a minimalist because they didn't have a better box to put him in, but later it turns out, and he made these, I don't know if you've seen his work, but they look, his sculptures look a lot like the monolith from 2001. and there's actually, he made a sculpture in 1968 that looks like the monolith, and there's some thought that Kubrick sort of appropriated it. But it later comes out that his art practice was the extension of an experience he had when he was like in sixth grade. He had a dream that he was walking home from school and that he was being monitored by aliens from the sky while he was walking home. And then he had a whole art career about his extraterrestrial encounter. And then when he was an old man, he had a dream that he was floating above his body and watching himself walk home from school, only to realize sort of at the end of his life and career that he was the eye in the sky, kind of.
Wow.
And to me, this is like this is the stuff that sort of gets swept under the rug. And there's a mythology. This is part of the mythology of John McCracken, and of course all the other minimalists in New York at the time, because he was in L.A. where all the other wackos were at the time. But in New York, all the minimalists were, you know, saying were phenomenologists or existentialists, and saying their work was what it was, and you know, a cube is a cube, and the material is the material, or whatever. The medium is a message, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it is true that there is an East Coast West Coast split this way, at least in the 20th century. I mean, I've been interested in and done a lot of research on the overlaps of you know, explicit religious or occult explorations and art practice in the West Coast, and it was just a less, you know, it was just a more open space. There's always been more wacky religion here, and there's something, you know, if you look at it from the other side, I mean, we've been talking about it sort of like from the art perspective, how these religious and spiritual practices might be useful and might actually help us reconceive art. But there's another way of thinking about it as well, which is that when, as modern people start to rediscover a kind of, or a desire for a kind of spiritual life, a kind of contact with the spectral, with the otherworldly, with the inner self, and trying to do that outside of the context of conventional religion, which is seen as, for very good reasons, as being sort of moribund or old school or kind of you know, claustrophobic for the individual, that at that point the movement towards a more spiritual life and the movement towards a more creative life and then a more artistic life are all very blurred. So you can also see these artists as really in some ways expressing what is most specific and in a way most beautiful about modern non-churched spirituality, which is not that it forms cults or that it forms weird New Age ideologies, although those have their appeal, but it's almost that they become a context for a broader, deeper, more expansive form of creativity itself, and that the creative life and the spiritual life are deeply, deeply entwined, at least in this kind of zone. So it's a really, you know, and once you start looking at art that way, there's tons of stuff. It's like you say, if you go through art history or conventional art discourse, it's very marginal, a little less so now. You know, the last 10, 15 years, there's been cracks and more people, even scholars, write about it. But until that point, nobody was talking about the fact that, abstract expressionism, the first gesture of modern art in its, you know, capital M phase, every one of those cats was immersed in mysticism and theosophy and thinking about, you know, the abstraction as a way of expressing these kind of astral forms, and Kandinsky wasn't alone. So it's like there really is a sort of suppressed history of art as spirituality that I think's different, though, in with this occult thing, with this relationship to the spirits. So I'm curious about that. Like, how is your feeling about what these things are, who these things are that you're contacting? How has that changed? I mean, you've been doing this for 10 years. You must have developed a different sense of who these characters are.
I guess what I can say, because I don't actually, the jury is still sort of out for me. What I can say is that they appear to be human ghost somethings, and I don't know what that means. And they, like, if you try to probe them, they won't give you much information as well, aside from simple information that we request, where they died or whatever. So they at least are performing as though they are a sort of ghost version of someone who lived before. But other than that, I kind of don't know, you know. It, and you know, I wish it, one thing I will say is that they're not evil or spooky or malicious. We get a lot of people. I'll call them people, and I don't like. I said this to you the other night. I don't like using the term paranormal because I don't, you know, if they are people, I don't want to call them abnormal or something. But they seem to be really average. I get more freaked out by people at the gas station than I do by people on the Ouija board.
Well, that's a wonderful way to place to take a take a break. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Maja Daou and myself, Eric Davis. We're talking with Christian Cummings. His partner, Michael Decker, has yet to reemerge from the ether, so hopefully we'll get a hold of him. And we'll be right back after these messages.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. Here talking with Eric Davis. We're talking about some spooky stuff, Ouija boards and soul talking and art from the netherworlds with Christian Cummings. And Eric had mentioned we had Christian at our Expanding Mind event. He did some psychography, which basically is allowing a path for ghosts to come in and draw. And Christian, one of the things I was really thinking about was a lot of the stuff you were saying about the nature of how this stuff comes in, that nature of inspiration, and then also the identity of these things. Like, what is it? Who is it? And just your comment with the averageness of them. I mean, I'm very struck in the times that I've seen it where it's very archetypal. Like, you know, you said there'll be these kind of famous celebrity folks or maybe even people claiming to be that. But what if I kind of step back from it a little bit and look at it just in terms of energy, right? Like the first drawing you said you got was a Ninja Turtle. So the energy aggregated around this form that had already been established in the universe, right? A Ninja Turtle has gotten so much kind of consciousness attributed to it that you could call it an archetype. It's a mythological figure, basically, right? So the fact that that was the form that the first drawing took, it took a vessel, right? It claimed the vessel of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle was how the energy came through. And so for me, all average people, every person, we all are, you know, these archetypes. People might not see that as, you know, maybe you're just a Togo sandwich worker, which doesn't seem exciting. And yet that dude that was the sandwich worker at Togo's was in his physical form kind of assuming these archetypal frequencies. So I wanted to ask you, what do you think about that maybe these things coming through, they don't really have, like, an identity per se. Maybe they're not, like, people or, like, a ghost or, like, a thing, but it's more like you guys are kind of opening a portal for energy to come through, and then it kind of, like, hops on a vessel and kind of comes out. I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, one of my, you know, I have a different theory for this every day, and I'm not someone who actually uses belief as like a something that I hold on to for my whole life. Usually I have a different belief about things, you know, every few hours. But one of my theories about it is that the ghosts are actually channeling Michael, who I'm sorry that you're having problems connecting to him, but since he's not coming through, I do want to at least talk about him right now, because Michael
yeah.
is an antenna in the most profound way, and I've done the process with other people. He's done the process with other people, with varying degrees of speed and fluidity. But with Michael, it's always amazing. And we've done drawings where Michael is talking on his cell phone, and I'm, you know, it's like the end of the day, and I'm tired, and I'm kind of like leaning on the edge of the couch, and the planchette is just like whizzing away. I think that whatever it is, you know, I don't know if we're channeling something or something's channeling us, but I think that Michael is connected somehow to whatever it is.
Hey, Christian, do you have happen to know Michael's number off the top of your head? We can give him a ring, try to get him back on.
Yeah, I can get it. I can get it for you. One moment. Should I just give it to you on the air?
Yeah, why not? Well, you probably don't want to do that. If you can email.
You're getting all kinds of phone calls on
yeah,
an antenna.
Right. Well, yeah, you don't want to do that. Michael doesn't want to be that kind of antenna. Who knows?
Exactly.
I love our listeners, but you never know.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm going to email it to you right now, and if you guys want to contact him,
yeah.
Go ahead. Okay.
Okay, well, and so that's an interesting idea, just to, like, go off on that, is the idea that we are all, we contain, like, all the archetypes, you know? Like, I mean, in a lot of that Jungian psychology stuff, we are houses for all the archetypes, and they kind of go through us and work through us. So the idea that these things are actually each parts of Michael is kind of amazing. Like, those are all things that are contained in him. Like, if he ever watched a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle cartoon, that's, like, stored inside him. So whatever it is that's coming out could be, like, some kind of thing like that, you know?
Yeah, and I will, you know, one thing that struck me about the performance at the Besant last week was that the drawings seemed to be almost like they were addressed to you. And this happens sometimes when, you know, like, we'll be in a certain location, and the drawing, like, one time we were doing a drawing in a apartment that Michael was house sitting for, and it was, there was like 100 butterflies, and then turned out in the hallway this person had butterfly displays that I just didn't notice. Or
wow.
You know, this happens, you know, depending on who you're doing it with. With Michael, there's a lot of sort of, a lot of the imagery speaks to the particular location where we're at. Like, another friend of mine who I've done the process with on several occasions, he always gets someone that he knows. And that person, it's always very intense and very creepy, and he steps away for a year and a half or so before he can do it again because he has to process what Grandpa said. So there's all, and Grandpa, in addition, Grandpa will talk about, like, relationships he's currently in and give him advice. And so person to person, the results are very, very different.
And then
yeah, I mean, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I was just going to say there's an inherent context, it seemed like, in each one of the performances that I've seen, and you're right, the environment influences it, the people that are there influence it, so it's kind of drawing not only from, like, the outer space ethers, but it's contextual, which is pretty nuts. It's almost like how that works for me in divination. Whenever I do divination, it is this otherworldly thing, but it also has direct kind of effect on what's happening, who's there, what's going on. And I mean, I felt like when I was watching the drawings, I knew exactly what the drawings were. They were a little obscure, you know, people were like looking at it like, what is that? But I felt like even as you were doing them, I knew exactly what the drawings were of. And I don't know if that's because they were talking to me or I could just like see them better. I don't know, but it was really, really unusual feeling for me to see it. I felt like I was participating, you know?
Right, and on top of, in addition, the drawings that happened on Saturday were very different than how the drawings normally are. And the fact that you immediately knew what they were when I looked at them, it looked like a, you know, a bowl of spaghetti. So that was an interesting thing for me personally. We've had, you know, the results always vary, but usually they stay within a certain kind of neighborhood aesthetically, because it's a single line drawing and the pen doesn't leave the page. And nine times out of ten, the ghost is drawing something that references their own personal life, situation, their death, the job they had, someone they admired, something like that. And we then obtain information afterwards, and it's very clear what they're depicting. This was, like, interesting. This particular night was interesting because the drawings were, like, three or four drawings layered on top of each other.
You know, I wanted to get back to something we were talking about a little bit earlier, and just in how this practice and experience has affected your, you know, larger ideas about art and your other artwork. And so I take it that probably some of the other things you do don't have necessarily an explicit occult dimension, but maybe in some ways you've come to approach them differently or think about them differently, or even articulate them. You know, and one of the pressures that artists have these days is to, you know, explain their work in some kind of recognizable sort of art discourse language, you know, in catalogs and articles and such. And I can't imagine that this hasn't also changed the way you actually describe what you do as well as think about it.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said before, I think the big lightning bolt for me from the project was that it was doing what art was always doing in some weird way. Like, you know, I think about how, just going back to the working in liminal territory, the idea of Picasso painting a woman to look deformed, and then that becomes a new code for beauty, or Diderot making treasures out of his trash, and now his urine paintings and chocolate sculptures are in cold storage at the Getty. Like, this, I think I'm starting to wrap my mind around this territory. And for me, it's more, it has more to do with this sort of, this idea that these things that are coming into my mind, that feel, unmotivated, that appear there without me motivating them there, those are the things that now I specifically pay attention to. Like, I'm like the like my eye is claiming stuff that comes from things that it doesn't make, if that makes sense. I call this zero person perspective. It's like the first person perspective, but without the eye involved. So what I'm doing now, I mean, it's, you know, I don't know if my art is any better for it. It's probably the worse for it. But, like, it's now become, you know, now the tangents have become more important for me than any sort of central motive that, you know, might drive what I do.
Wonderful. Well, I think we have our other spectral presence has arrived. Michael, you are on the line.
Hi.
Hi, man. Sorry about that.
No problem.
Very mysterious, indeed. Well, in a way, I want to ask you the same question. I'm not really. Be great to hear a little bit about what other work you do as an artist, and then how these experiences have changed your larger ideas about art and art practice.
Well, I have a drawing practice that is sort of what I consider a more meditative practice that I do every day. But it's very, very different from the drawings that are produced with Christian and Luigi. So I don't really know if there's any dialogue between them other than a sort of tactile engagement. However, with Christian, it's I'm not responsible for coming up with the themes of the drawings, whereas with my drawings, I'm more responsible for deciding the subject matter and different compositional concerns, I guess.
do you have any techniques that you employ when you do your meditative drawing stuff?
Well, they're really small, detailed renderings, and they usually involve large civilizations of people, naked people, and lots of various architectures and building methods are involved. And I mean, I think it's a little more coming out of some kind of interest in histories with illustration and kind of similar to the drawings by Mark Hanford for the Where's Waldo?
And then, Christian had been mentioning that you sort of feel these presences more, perhaps, than he does in terms of a real sense of their kind of personality. And again, you know, having done this for a long time, but coming, you know, at it from an interesting angle, not a typical sort of Ouija board user's perspective, how have you come to experience these presences in your own practice and your sense of who they are, where they are, how they work? How has that changed over time?
Well, I think when we started drawing with the Ouija board, I had sort of set my drawing practice aside, and we were in school, and the program is more concerned with conceptual art, modes of production, and drawing in this sort of all these interests with illustration were not really accommodated for with the program. So it was interesting getting into the Ouija drawing, because all of a sudden the first one that we drew was a Ninja Turtle, and it was like there was this potential for expressing ideas that were coming from somewhere that neither me nor Christian were really consciously engaged with.
And then, do they seem like live to you? Do they seem like persons? Does it seem like something on another level of? I mean, we were talking earlier. Perhaps this is something dredging up from your own unconscious. Does that make sense? Or when you do you hear that and you go, "No, it's something more than that."
No, I mean, I think that there's something to be said for the actual experience of having your hand on the planchette and having Christian's hand on the planchette, and this sort of offering of faculties in a way that is, it feels generous and unconscious. So sometimes I feel like I am sort of providing an antenna of sorts to communicate, but I don't really know if it's like subconsciously bound to me or Christian, or if it's coming through a larger set of concerns. Like a lot of the information we've gathered I was not privy to before they communicated it on the Ouija, so, and I think the same thing for Christians. So.
Well, does it ever happen to you in places outside of this? Like, have you ever kind of had your antenna activated in other times when you're not drawing, where it's just kind of taking you over and stuff comes in, or is that the only place where this happens?
No, I think I live my life like that, but I think that this is just sort of a form that's been sort of harnessed or with through experience and then sort of cultivated, and now we can just sit down and know that something interesting is about to happen, and that happens every single time. So it's just this there's something really nice about knowing that something's going to happen, but not sure what is going to be produced from it.
Christian, I also wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit about what some of your other work is, like what other projects you're involved in right now.
One project that I've been sort of working on for the last couple of years was I built my backyard into a metal foundry and then was developing techniques, metallurgic techniques for making a thing expressively, quickly, or impulsively, but out of aluminum, which is a metal that won't oxidize. So, and the purpose was to sort of save these very quick, impulsive expressions in a form that will out-survive the human species. With the intention of them being discovered by extraterrestrial anthropologist aliens or something. Just this idea of, I'm becoming increasingly more interested in not the sort of anchor ideas that like knock you over and then you go and spend the next 500 hours building a thing that communicates the idea, but all of the thought content that happens in between, you know, your momentary desires, your laundry, you got to do the laundry, you got to get this at the store, I would like to watch this movie, these kinds of things that are unimportant, and projecting those out as the content of my life. And then also I'm making a movie retelling the Adam and Eve story.
Oh, just a small
story. Include laundry.
Well, yeah, it's a retelling.
Yeah, that whole idea about including all of this kind of the bric-a-brac, mundane bric-a-brac of ordinary consciousness. It's really interesting to me how much magic seems to lie in there. That, like, in a way, like, even if you want to think of it as a cutting edge, which is already kind of an old modernist idea, but the cutting edge of spirit, of the occult, of this kind of work with consciousness, it somehow it sits right there, right in the mundane details of this thing and all my laundry list and this and that. It's like there's and if the past it was all about sort of creating a strong distinction between the sacred and the profane, it seems like it's our kind of work and to like look at how those things are together, because it seems to me that what you're just describing there is very similar to the opening that allows spirits to come through your hand and to inscribe something, even though it may look very differently, because you're talking about long to-do lists and the sort of chatter of the ordinary. But there's something about that opening up that seems similar.
Yeah, I always thought that the sort of logical conclusion of the surrealist diving into psychology would be would parallel the way technology happens and would turn into nanopsychology, where we can like go in further and further into, because it seems like right now we are still stuck on the monumental kinds of forms of expression. I think, and also I think about this all the time with the internet. Like some guy publishes a blog about which is like a fictional history of umbrellas or something. And normally this wouldn't make it into our story because it's expensive to make a book and it has to be publishable or whatever. But now we have all of these new ways of engaging with culture that allow us to talk about the unimportant stuff. And it starts getting really interesting. Like you look at YouTube for 5 minutes and you start thinking like, why am I even an artist? Because people are doing this so much better than me.
That's a wonderful place. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Just really briefly, if people wanted to find out more about you guys' work, do you have like a URL you can just shout out here in our last minute?
My website is christiancummingsart.com, and there's a, if you click into art, there's a spectral psychography box that will go to our most recent exhibition. And then Michael has a website too. What he can give
I
that to
you. I think it's michaeldecker.net. It's actually just a Tumblr site that I, a blog site, but I have some photos of work up on it.
Great. Well, thanks so much, you guys. Really appreciate your being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, from me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.